3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognize their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double. Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is Thursday, the 25th of June. Good morning, Kate. Good morning, Layla.
Good morning, Priya and Kate.
Good morning. Good morning, Layla, Priya.
Very cute. How are you both today?
Yeah, I'm good. It was very foggy this morning and it was actually really beautiful.
I love the fog.
Yeah. It is a little bit. It reduces visibility a bit.
It does.
Yeah, I say this having cycled in and was just like, I can't see very much, but it is...
It's kind of relaxing.
Yeah, and also I am the main character in a movie if I get hit by a car this morning because it's so cinematic.
Is that how you stay motivated to ride every day?
That's how I stay motivated to ride. Spite. We have a big show, very big show. Today, where we're going into some bits of archival audio. We're having a couple of amazing accompanying interviews. And of course, we're sharing some really vital news about current events, as we always do. So first up, we are going to listen to a little bit more archival audio as part of 3CR's 50th anniversary celebrations, where last week we played part of the 2000 protests against the World Economic Forum from the 11th to the 13th of September 2000 at the Crown Casino Complex in Melbourne. And we're going to play a little bit more of that audio today.
And after that, we hear a 1998 interview with the 3CR station manager, Jan MacArthur, who was the station manager at the time, which happened on Wednesday home time. I think it's, is it 38 years ago? Which is
I'm not doing
just
math.
1 year after I was born. In this excerpt that you're going to hear this morning, it's really interesting, and Jan discusses the legitimacy of the 1997 Victorian secret police infiltration that saw undercover officers pose as 3CR programmers and even undertake the community-funded 3CR training program. 3CR was one of multiple community organisations surveilled and monitored by Victoria Secret Police during a four-year national security intelligence project that resulted in an ombudsman investigation due to its questionable legality and ethical conduct by police.
Victoria's Secret Police. Sorry. I was like, Victoria's Secret Police or Victoria's Secret Police? 28 years. And after that, we're going to be joined by trans activist Hazel to talk about the rise of electoral fascism and the failure of liberal politics in so-called Australia. And Hazel is also going to share some information about an upcoming counter-protest for trans liberation, which is happening on Saturday, the 4th of July, on the steps of Parliament House. Now, Saturday, the 4th of July, is also 3CR's 50th anniversary. And if you get organized, you will be able to attend both. So think about that.
And after that interview, we're going to hear a follow-up to our archival segment about the police infiltration. And we're going to hear from Zelda to understand how policing and legislative tactics like hate crime law and the Security Investigation Unit, or SIU, and the Federal Joint Counterterrorism Team, JCTT, are leveraged currently to further criminalise liberatory justice movements and silence political speech. Zelda has been active in earth and human rights struggles on this continent and the Pacific region for decades and was a core organiser of Disrupt Land Forces. Currently, Zelda is preparing to head to Pine Gap for next month's Sacred Land Back Convergence, and we hope to see you there. We'll include the details for that in our show notes.
Amazing. Then after that, we'll be joined by Lucinda Thorpe from Digital Rights Watch to discuss some concerns about WA Police's expansion of facial surveillance. And this is extremely worrying as it acts as a disproportionate and terrifying overreach of police infrastructure that risks many people who are not guilty of any crime just being surveilled and criminalized because of the expansion of these powers.
Finally, we will be joined by Anitra Nelson, who is an activist scholar with the Informal Urbanism Research Hub at the University of Melbourne, who investigates post-capitalism and non-monetary economies. She's also a previous 3CR programmer with Chile Luce. As 3CR has looked back at the 2000 Melbourne S11 protests, we're joined by Anitra Nelson, to discuss the phenomenon of degrowth, and she will speak with us about its relationship in regards to the globalised and capitalist world that we live in today.
Amazing. So stay tuned. We are with you all the way to 8:30 this morning, and we'll be back to you shortly with the news headlines for today.
Public transport's great.
What's not great is that unless you've got a radio with you, you can't listen to 3CR when you're on it.
Until now. The Community Radio Plus app lets you listen to us wherever you are.
Get on board and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and these are the news headlines for Thursday, the 25th of June. An 8-week extension to the Senate inquiry examining controversial National Disability Insurance Scheme, or NDIS, changes has been granted after sustained pressure from people with disability, advocacy organisations and service providers, who say the original consultation process was rushed and inadequate. The bill had originally been expected to pass Parliament during the current sitting period, but the inquiry was extended after more than 4,000 submissions were lodged in just over 2 weeks. Advocates say the delay was won through community campaigning and is needed to properly scrutinise reforms that could remove more than 200,000 people from the NDIS and reduce access to essential supports. An interim report from the Senate inquiry was published earlier this week that still recommends the bill pass, though with some clarifications and a roadmap for change. Disability organisations maintain that despite some amendments already made to the bill, the proposed changes still pose significant risks to people with disability and must go through genuine consultation before any legislation proceeds.
Also in news this week, a third confirmed case of H5 bird flu has been detected in a migratory giant petrel in the Fluorio Peninsula in South Australia, and authorities in Western Australia are investigating another suspected case near Dunsborough in southwestern Australia. Officials emphasise that the case in South Australia is with a migratory bird, and say there is no evidence the virus is spreading between states through poultry populations. Health officials say the risk to human health remains low as surveillance and testing continues.
In other news, Victorian teachers and education support staff have overwhelmingly rejected the Victorian government's enterprise and pay rise agreement, with nearly 58% voting against the deal and against the Australian Education Union's recommendation to accept it. The result marks the first time in more than 40 years that the rank and file members have rejected an Australian Education Union endorsed agreement, affirming feedback from members that the union leadership is failing to listen to members. Following the vote, the union resolved to reject the offer from the state government, resume negotiations with the Department of Education, and consult members on possible future industrial action.
Also in headlines, federal government departments, including social services and aged care, will appear before the ongoing Senate inquiry into racism, hate and violence directed at Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. The inquiry has heard mounting evidence that racism against Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people remains systemic and harmful across governments and society in so-called Australia. Submissions to the inquiry from government agencies, academics and First Nations organisations cite widespread discrimination in health, education, housing, employment, and the justice system. The First Nations Digital Inclusion Advisory Group told the inquiry that racism, hate, and violence directed at First Nations people is rife in online environments, describing how digital spaces have become one of the primary places where racism is created and amplified.
Finally, in headlines, reports from the court proceedings in pianist Jason Gillan's unfair dismissal case against the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra have revealed explosive evidence and testimony detailing allegations that internal MSO decision-making was influenced by pro-Israel donors and stakeholders. Evidence presented in the federal court case includes testimony where an MSO board member denied that Palestinian civilians and journalists were deliberately killed, and minutes from the internal meetings discussing requests from donors for the MSO to take a pro-Israel stance. The court was also shown records indicating far more public complaints were received about Gillam's cancellation than about his remarks supporting Palestinians. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 25th of June. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
The Electronic Intifada is Palestine's weapon of mass instruction.
Netanyahu's at the zenith of his genocidal career.
These people committed atrocities.
This is a war on children, essentially.
Tune into Electronic Intifada Radio for interviews, reports, and analysis Thursdays at 7 p.m. on 855 AM, 3CR Digital, and online at 3cr.org.au.
This is starvation. Time is running out.
You're tuned in to Thursday Breakfast, and it is 7:11 in the morning. And now we're going to take you back 26 years to another part of the pivotal protests against the World Economic Forum from the 11th to the 13th of September 2000, otherwise called the S11 protests at the Crown Casino Complex in Melbourne, which brought disparate organizing groups together into a broad coalition against globalization and multinational domination. We played a little excerpt of this last week, and this is another part of 3CR's coverage of the massive public opposition from our compiled highlights of the broadcast on a 12-part CD titled Globalization Unplugged.
In the media again, in the radio reports, this whole thing about the World Economic Forum. Every time there's an attack on S11, the violence, the police, the brutality. What the hell are they talking about in terms of what is the globalization problem? Why are these people taking to the streets? Why is there so much of outburst? None of that is discussed.
In terms of, I suppose, the lead up to these protests, I mean, do you think that... Oh, it's getting very loud down here, Dave. But, Pauline, do you think that partly there was an attempt to try to demonise the protests today through, you know, the kinds of media hype that was going on about the potential for violence? Yeah, we've been concerned that really the public has been softened up for violence, and what our experience in the 90s in Victoria has been the violence has come from police, not from protesters.
This morning there were very small numbers on the various points around the Crown Casino and limited observation by the media and others. The police have taken the opportunity to essentially use extreme force against the crowd in a number of instances.
Commercial television would like you to believe that people peacefully picketing are the troublemakers and not the police, and it's the police who have so far perpetrated all the violence. Police really did lose, I'm afraid.
Well, that is contrary to reports on other media outlets who are saying that nothing much is happening, that all the delegates are already in there and there's no reason to protest. So.
Well, the mainstream media can say that, Jay. I was the recipient of three batons in the stomach, even though I told them that I was only there taking photographs and that's all I was doing. Mm-hmm. It wasn't interfering, wasn't shouting, wasn't pushing and whatever. It didn't matter who you were, you got the same treatment.
It's very interesting to see how things have shifted the last few days, and I think one of the turning points there is that so many media representatives were actually assaulted in the attack last night. I've heard a figure that there were 10 media people who were actually baton charged, otherwise hit or bent under horses last night, and so I think that that's had quite an influence in regards to them listening to what the protesters have been saying all along, and that was that the police were behaving in an entirely inappropriate and over-the-top way.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. That was a clip from the S11 protests outside the World Economic Forum from the 11th to the 13th of September 2000 at the Crown Casino in Melbourne. And now we are going to another piece of archival audio. So, Kate, take it away. Leila.
Yes. Over to you. Yes, I have been listening and researching this, which is really enriching. Like, I just love being able to go back through the archives and dedicating time to that. And yeah, we're going to hear a 1998 interview with 3CR station manager of the time, Jan MacArthur, who spoke on Wednesday Home Time. In this excerpt, Jan is interviewed about the legitimacy of the 1997 Victorian secret police infiltration that saw undercover officers pose as 3CR programmers and undertake the community-funded 3CR training program. Obviously, the community didn't know that they were funding undercover cops to undertake training, and there was definitely feelings about the fact that that had happened afterwards. And Jan says that she did send them a bill after she found out that it had happened. So during this period of time, late 90s, 3CR was one of multiple community organisations that were surveilled and monitored by the Victorian Secret Police during a four-year national security intelligence project that actually resulted in an ombudsman investigation due to the project's questionable legality and questionable ethical conduct by police.
Listeners to 3CR will remember in January last year the sad saga of the Victorian Police secret files. Well, 3CR was one of the many community organisations infiltrated by the secret police over a number of years. Following revelations by the Age newspaper that some files relating to these activities of the special branch had not in fact been destroyed as ordered by the government, but been removed from the special branch office in 1983, the state ombudsman, Mr. Barry Perry, carried out a special investigation. Jan MacArthur is our station manager here at 3CR, and she was station manager at the time of the secret files revelation. Good afternoon, Jan.
Hi, Nala. Thanks for inviting me on.
Thanks for joining us on Wednesday Home Time. Jan, the Ombudsman's final report on police intelligence operations have been tabled in the Parliament. Were you surprised at the findings?
Well, to be honest, I viewed it more from a layperson's perspective. So I'm sure there are some listeners out there who are going to have a much more thorough knowledge of this whole issue than I do. But I probably view it from the average person's point of view, and that's a non-legal point of view. I think it was a little bit of a red herring myself. I think focusing only on the conspiracy aspect was a great way of avoiding scrutinising the bigger issues of social justice that were raised and that we certainly raised when it was exposed that we were infiltrated. I think that the investigation came out of a witness stating that the files had been stashed away to be used at a later date by a new government. And certainly, you know, if that was the case, that's an issue to be concerned about. But there were many more issues that we raised with regards to police powers, their legitimacy in infiltrating a community organisation, you know, a whole range of issues. Do you want me to recap the issues that we were concerned with at the time?
That'd be great.
And it might be worth following up with the Federation of Community Legal Services, because I know that from a legal point of view they've been following this more closely, and we might get some clearer legal analysis from them in the future. But the issues that we raised at the time were that that it was, well, firstly a waste of public money, that to infiltrate 3CR for 3 years and spend, you know, pay wages of people to come in here and be trained would have been money better spent donated to 3CR to pay for staff, but certainly would have been cheaper for them to buy a transistor and tune in, because more gets said on air than off air at 3CR, so the need to infiltrate was a bit of a furphy. Also that they infiltrated non-violent organisations, and with the, you know, the premise of learning, for example, how animal liberationists operate, and you have to say, well, how is that legitimate, working out how to operate in a non-violent way in protection of state and national security. I think also that the police would in fact, well, did argue that they were legitimate in their activities if there was a threat to national or state security, and we found it very hard to see through the files of all the list of community organisations and individuals that were surveilled and monitored, we couldn't see how there was any pattern of any threat to national or state security. We also found that we were concerned that there was an abuse of trust in the community's resources, that they in fact paid these undercover cops to come in here, but we trained them. The community paid for them to learn at 3CR and to be here to keep the station going. So in effect, we were paying for them to broadcast and, I guess, create jobs for themselves with no return.
So you're going to send them your bill?
We did send them a bill.
Oh, you did?
We did. We did send them a bill.
What happened?
Well, the treasury of the state police rang up and said, "Now, can you tell us where this secret police department is?" And we said, "Well, if you don't know, how are we supposed to know? Maybe you should send it to your own ombudsman or your ethics department." They said, "Oh, thanks. That's a good idea. We'll do that." So they ended up saying that they couldn't find their secret police, and we thought, well, at least they've been hiding from you. But the Age managed to find them. Also, I think, I guess one of our other concerns was there was a political bias to their work, in that all the individuals and groups were clearly, well, probably 90 to 95% were left-wing, could be said to be left-wing very clearly, and non-violent groups. So for them to operate legitimately in the best interests of state and national security was very questionable, when it was clearly the object of their targets were political grouping. Also, the other major concern was that many of these investigations and infiltrations were conducted after the Special Operations Branch disbanded. So the fact that the files had been put away, and that some witness said they may be used at a later date by other governments, was really only one of many, many concerns that we had, which I think haven't been addressed. And I think this was a great way to avoid the issue.
Absolutely. Has the discovery of the existence of the secret files on 3CR and the fact that we were infiltrated had any long-term effect, do you think, on the 3CR and its community?
I think the fact that we were infiltrated, you know, to one degree, there are a lot of people with great senses of humour around 3CR who said, well, we, you know, that just justifies what we, and states, confirms what we knew all along. Also that we're clearly doing a good job if people think we're so threatening that, you know, we are actually having an impact out there in the community. But I think, the fact that the files, they say, were lost, well, I'm kind of glad that they were lost so that they could be found by the Age, because we would never have had proof of that level of infiltration that was going on.
You just heard an interview from 1998 with 3CR station manager at the time, Jan MacArthur, who spoke about 3CR's 1997 Victorian secret police infiltration that saw undercover police train and pose as 3CR programmers. And that provides some of the context that I'll be following up with an interview about current ways that policing and legislative tactics are being used to further criminalise liberatory justice movements. And I'll be speaking to Zelda about that later.
Yeah,
really looking forward to that.
I mean, I feel like the interview that we're about to go into will pick up on some of that environment as well, and how that's been developing over time, and increasing fascistic space, and the importance of anti-fascist action on the streets. And so now I am joined by trans activist Hazel, who's speaking with us about the rise of electoral fascism and the failure of liberal politics in so-called Australia, and also sharing some information about an upcoming counter-protest for trans liberation and against fascism on Saturday, the 4th of July, on the steps of Parliament House. Now, for more information about the action, you can head to Instagram and look up the accounts of Trans Queer Solly 2026 or trans.action.network. But good morning, Hazel.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining
us. Welcome to be our Thursday breakfast.
Yes, it's really nice to have you on. Now, I thought we could just jump right into it, and I wanted to ask if you could unpack some of the liberal whiplash regarding the rise and rise of Pauline Hanson. So it seems like over the last few months, there's been a bit of a shift from crowing over the fracturing of the right with the fall of the coalition to a rising panic about the ability of liberal centrism to hold out against this ascendant fascist fringe. What do you make of the political landscape that we're in right now?
Yeah, it definitely seems like there's been a political shift that's gone on. And I think it shows a number of things. I think it shows, like, the notion of, like, racism from above and racism from below. So I guess we're seeing, like, racism from below that's often stoked by far-right groups. It's stoked by the nature of, like, Australia as a colonial capitalist nation that's founded on, like, genocide of First Nations people, it's founded on the White Australia policy. These things mean these things are incredibly structural and, you know, as, like, Robbie Thorpe says, Australia is the institution of racism. So we see, like, that's the, like, soil in which this like, far-right stuff comes from. The racism from above part is, like, the likes of, you know, Pauline Hanson and Gina Reinhart. And, like, yeah, even, like, Reinhart's history around, like, Hancock cross-wrecking and her father, who's, like, infamously quoted as, like, wanting to poison Aboriginal people. It's really just this legacy of ongoing things. So I guess, like the media exceptionalizes these times, but I would guess put them in, like a continuity of, like, racism in Australia. But what's different now is the media sort of normalizing Hanson, like, going on a press club the other week. All these things are just normalizing Hanson and just shifting to, like, the more overt racism of Hanson versus the more, like, polite liberal racism of Australia, I guess.
Mm. Yeah, I appreciate you, talking about the role of the media in this as well, because I think that is where a lot of the conversation has been playing out about both the, like, sudden surprise that Australia has, like, these deep ongoing racist undercurrents, but at the same time providing a platform for that to be, like, ventilated to a national audience. So I guess I wanted to pivot a bit and ask if you think there's any relationship between what we've seen in terms of, like, legal reforms, the criminalization of neo-Nazi groups, where those legislative reforms have primarily been designed to crack down on Palestine solidarity actions, and then the rise in popularity of electoral fascism through the likes of One Nation. Do you see any connections there? How do you read those shifts?
Yeah, I think this question really goes to part of how, like, liberalism paves the way for fascism, because we think of, like, the criminalization stuff in the last few years. It's all been around, like, Palestine. So it's all, like, so there's a whole, like, anti-Muslim, like, racist tone to it all. Or it's also about, like, this rhetoric around tough on crime, which is also, like, a racist idea, because who are the people that have to resort to, like, different things to survive that are criminalized? And it's primarily, like, racialized people of color, First Nations people, poor people, a whole, like, smattering of different communities. So in terms of, the Nazi element of things, so I guess, like, one of the things that's happening is this idea of, like, hate, and hate crime is being used as I guess Dylan Rodriguez talks about it as like lexical warfare. So it's a regime that's sort of like everyone's against hate. It's sort of like it's kind of like this thing the state uses to be like, oh, we can't be against everyone's like against hate. But like the state's idea of hate isn't like a cop bashing someone. It isn't like the state like killing people through NDIS cuts. That's not hate. So hate includes like things that are like racial violence, like certain Nazi acts, and of course we and the left are against those things, but also includes like Palestine action. And we know that there's been use of like hate crime laws both against the right and against the left. I myself was like raided like a month or two ago by Victoria Police because like partly on the basis of using these new hate crime laws in Victoria. So, like, the political context is that we should always be wary about expanding police powers because it's going to be used against us, and we need, like, the way to, like, smash racism, to smash Nazis is, like mass, like, anti-racism from below. Like, so-called anti-racism by the state only just ends up increasing racism because the whole state apparatus, police and prisons, is the institution of racism. So even if they, like, crack down a certain Nazi, they face charges, blah, 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 it doesn't actually deal with the source of the problem. And that's the reason why that isn't going to work. And we shouldn't be complacent that it is going to work. Mm. So I would argue we should be against the whole apparatus of, like, hate as a form of, like, criminalization and increased policing.
Yeah, and, you know, thinking about how this plays out on the street and in the way that the police are increasingly enabled to crack down on folks engaged in anti-fascist resistance and, you know, surveil anti-fascist and anti-racist activism from below, it also shows you know, how farcical the liberal establishment is when while enacting these draconian laws, at the same time sort of doing this hand-wringing about, you know, the expression of these sentiments in a very overt way by politicians like Pauline Hanson and, you know, other folks associated with One Nation, but not being in a position to overtly condemn what they're saying without looking like hypocrites themselves, because, of course, you know, this is a continuum of behavior rather than a distinct break between liberal centrism and the far right.
Yeah, and if I could just also add in, because I think it was cool that I heard from that excerpt about like 3CR being surveilled by undercover police, because I think there's kind of this idea that that police are a neutral institution, whereas like if you look at the history of Victoria Police, like one of their main functions is like repression and squashing dissent. So I guess we can't be surprised, and their whole framework is, they kind of like see like any political activity as like really interconnected, and they worry about it turning into like organizing against the state. And I guess there's like truth in that. Like radical ideas do lead to people wanting to like change the system. So yeah, it's good to hear that part, because I think sometimes it's like surprise on the left. It's like, oh, how could like Victoria Police want to target or surveil X sort of protesters are not doing anything, but it's like part of the framework of like squashing dissent, and it actually is like the police working as they're being designed and set up to, because there's long the history of like special branches that we like used to like surveil people on the left, to now like this idea of counterterrorism, which really, when it's like targeted at the left, it's really like the function of like counter-liberation is probably their way of describing what they're doing.
Yeah, and like it is imperative that we don't just let that recognition of the relationship between political education and political action be only, I guess, confined to the police and repressive action, but remember what you know, what that does for us as a movement and the importance of continuing to raise these concerns, to speak up, and then to take action as well. Like, we're not going to change anything if we allow the intended chilling effects to set in of this kind of repression. Now, I wanted to also, you know, ask about transphobia as part of this. And I'm thinking, you know, from the conservative Protect Mardi Gras faction that's pushing transphobia on the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras board to Pauline Hanson's own reference to the transgender insurgency. Now, the connections that some may have been hesitant to make in the past between transphobia and fascism, even in the wake of neo-Nazis showing up to anti-trans rallies, are increasingly becoming abundantly clear. Now, I wanted to ask you about the relationship between fascism and transphobia in this place, and particularly trans misogyny in this political moment.
Cool. Yeah, thanks for that. There's a lot to unpack there. But I guess I'll start with, like, one of the central ideas of fascism is, like, hierarchy and authoritarianism, and that's, like, around the patriarch, like, particularly the white patriarch, but obviously fascism emerges in different racial contexts. And so the idea is, like, upholding the idea of, like, the ruler of the family, the ruler. And trans people are a threat to that in the sense that we deviate from, like, hierarchical gender expectations and roles. We upset these, like, ideas around biological essentialism, around, like, people, like, women naturally being inferior, or these, like, forced ideas of gender that people can't deviate from. And that's, like, a threat to these, this idea of, like, the white, nuclear, patriarchal, cis, heterosexual family. And I guess trans misogyny in general has more origins in colonialism, to, like, people that perceived by colonialists as, like, deviant from their ideas of these patriarchal ideas of gender, like, heavily policed, but, like, othered, and that meant, like, trans feminized people, like, were criminalized a lot, and that's, like, also inherent in policing in prison today. Like, if your identity is seen as questionable or whatever around, like, gender and stuff, like, police are trained to, like, be suspicious of you. Mm. And that particularly plays out, like, around poor people, like, poor trans women who are also people of colour, disabled. These things are represented in, like, policing. So in terms of, like, the Pauline Hanson part of thing, I think it represents, like, her mobilising, like trans transphobia from below, also, and joining with transphobia from above, because we see it in terms of the transphobia from above. We see, like, prisons, like, treat trans women in prison, like, horribly, mostly in men's prisons, denied, like, hormones, all these horrible things every day, even in, like, so-called liberal states. And also see, like, a general, like, trans, so even trans misogyny people are recruited into that tells them that, like, kicking down the trans women gives them a, like, is a thing that we should maintain, and it gives people a sense of, like, supremacy and power, rather than actually looking at how, like, trans liberation is bound up with liberation of all genders, liberation of women, because it, like, relieves us from these rigid, like, gender expectations, and against, like, hierarchy, like, how women receive.
Yeah.
So much less pay, so much to do with domestic labour, so much, like, intimate partner violence, all these things. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it relies on this, I guess, one part of it is this aggressive normative force, and the other part is, like, using those norms to then control how people behave and interact with each other in society. And by you know, spilling across so many of those boundaries of normativity and control and exceeding those, transness is a threat. And on Saturday, the 4th of July, I know there's a counter protest that's planned against a rally in support of anti-trans business owner Sal Grover, who lost in court against trans woman Roxanne Tickle over the exclusion of trans women from the Giggle dating app. Now, that's the context for the rally, but I was wondering if you could share a bit more about what we know about the rally and the importance of confronting transphobia and fascism on the streets.
Yeah, cool. Thanks. So like the political context is a whole lot of like reactionary anti-trans circles that are in uproar around like the Sal Grover loss over her like app that wanted to exclude trans women. The case is like was against like trans woman Roxanne Tickle. And part of that is also that her case was like partly funded by the Alliance Defending Freedom International, a US Christian legal advocacy organization, to about $15,000 in legal fees, which Crikey reported on. So like this whole like moment is like there's a lot of different forces, anti-trans forces. We've got like the international like Christian, like far right sort of Christian groups. We have like Pauline Hanson, which is also overlapping with that. We have like so-called radical feminists that have their own sort of like recruitment into like reactionary ideas around these things. And we have like all these really like overt Nazis as well that are constantly like mobilizing really overt, disgusting trans misogyny. So like this political climate is this political climate where it's actually important to come to the streets, because often like in this climate, like we're like harassed in toilets more, we're harassed in our families more, we're harassed in these things. So I think actually coming together, trans, non-trans, cis people, everyone who stands for trans liberation, is actually a way of like building community and solidarity, because often we're quite isolated in these times of like fear that are being spread. That's the function, is to try to make us disappear. So this rally has been called in that context, and it's actually, these rallies are like in most cities. So these anti-trans networks have called these rallies. So this is a time to like take to the streets and show that there is like solidarity with trans people. And I guess, yeah, encourage everyone. You can make it, even though I know it's a day, there's a lot of things on, including 3CR 50th. And congrats to 3CR 50 years.
Thank you. But really encourage people to get down. And as I mentioned before, if you get organized and you think about your schedule, you will be able to attend both. So I encourage people to think about what you can do to make sure that you show up. I mean, the 50th birthday is a really special celebration, but also this is a moment that we can't forget about, you know, what 3CR means in the community, and that is supporting radical movements. So if you can get out there, please do. It's from 11:30 a.m. on the steps of Parliament House. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Hazel. We will have links in our show notes to places where you can find more information, but appreciate you making the time this morning.
Cool. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And that was trans activist Hazel, who joined us for a conversation about the rise of electoral fascism, the failure of liberal politics in so-called Australia, and shared some information about an upcoming counter-protest for trans liberation on Saturday, the 4th of July, on the steps of Parliament House. You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 PM on Saturdays here on 3CR 855 and AM dial podcast, streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. Now, over the years, there has been so much evidence that police counter-terrorism strategies target liberatory justice movements and non-violent organisations. As you heard in the archive audio we played earlier, 3CR, along with multiple other community organisations, was monitored by secret police in the 90s under the veil of counter-terror intelligence gathering. However, this justification was widely contested. To understand more about how things like hate crime law, the Security Investigation Unit, or SIU, and the Federal Joint Counterterrorism Team, JCTT, are leveraged currently to further criminalise liberatory justice movements and silence political speech, we are now joined by organiser and activist Zelda. Good morning, Zelda.
Hi, how are you going?
I'm good, thanks. Thank you so much for your time this morning. And I guess let's get straight into it because we've got quite a bit to cover. So
great.
Since 2023, we've seen a range of different legislative and policing strategies used to suppress anti-war, anti-racism movements and a range of political speech. What does it mean to criminalise resistance movements and criminalise protest?
Well, it means people get penalised for speaking out and for, you know, exercising what we like to think of as a fundamental human right to publicly dissent, to engage in public discourse, to protest.
Yeah, thanks for, I think that's a good, you know, kind of way to ground our values to begin with, that this is a human right and it's something that we should all be expecting that we're able to do. We should expect that we have the freedom to speak out about these things. That's our right. Now, onto how this is actually enforced. Could you tell me a bit about how police run so-called counter-terrorism efforts? What kind of units are involved and what do they actually do?
Well, at the moment, any type of protester comes under counter-terrorism. So any kind of protest group, whether it's a peace group or an environment, you know, could be a group of local people trying to protect a particular, you know, tree, like, we're all under issue-motivated group, and that comes under counter-terror. So it means that, I'm going to say on air, anyone from ISIS or, the sort of worst, most violent issue-motivated groups,
mm-hmm.
right through to your local land care organisation can come under counter-terror. So what we're seeing counter-terror police used for is to go after, at the moment, Palestine protesters in particular. They're also being used against trans rights protesters, feminists, like the left, basically. That's what we're seeing on the ground. And I would mention that like 20 women have been raided that I know of in Victoria in the last couple of months by counter-terror police. So that involves, they're all dawn raids that will happen on a Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And that involves like 12 counter-terror police breaking your door down and storming into your house and turning your house inside out, like your jewellery, your underwear, your photographs, like everything. Just absolutely trashing your house. For crimes like graffiti and littering.
Mm.
And in four of those 20 cases, there was no charge associated with the raids. They were raids where the police are hoping to find evidence that's of an alleged crime. But there's actually no charges against people. So to see 12 count, like this happened to me a month ago, so 12 counter-terror police barged into my house and turned my house upside down, detained me for 8 hours, and this was after a five-minute piece of political theatre at the US consulate, in which I think if I did break a law, it was littering. Mm. Like, that's the worst offence that I think happened at that event. In the meantime, you've got someone like Desi Freeman, who is a known violent offender with sociopathic attitudes,
who has guns, he didn't get raided by counter-terror police. He got six ordinary police from the local station, you know, the blue shirt police, and he bloody killed two of them. So, you know, it's certainly looking like counter-terror police are much more interested in left-wing protesters than they are in actual gun-toting violent offenders. As would have been noted, the people who committed the Bondi massacre were also not raided by counter-terror police.
Mm.
The two sovereign citizens in Queensland who also killed three people, also not raided by counter-terror police. They were also ordinary police who were sent to their homes. So, yeah, it's what are the counter-terror police doing? They seem to be completely preoccupied with issue-motivated groups, and there seem to be a particular tranche of issue-motivated groups that they're interested in, which is people on the left, libertarian social movement.
Can you tell me a bit more about the changes and adjustments you've seen to hate crime laws and how they're being used differently? As we know that these laws or similar laws have been used in similar ways to target non-violent resistance. But what are your reflections on how they've changed more recently?
I don't think I've seen like hate speech law weaponized against the left before. Like, usually we're the people who are speaking against hate speech.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, well, we are. We still are. You know, completely opposed to hate speech. We won't platform it. We won't engage in it. And you know, the whole pro-Palestine movement is, you know, has had to live with this, you know, fiction that we're anti-Semitic and that we're, what we're all about is hating Jewish people. And it's just, it's so completely untrue. And anyone who's part of the pro-Palestine movement knows that there are a lot of Jewish people in the movement as well, and that anti-Zionist Jews have really sort of come out as leaders in the movement. So it's, yeah, because you sent me the questions, I had a look at, you know, hate speech laws impacting the left, and I haven't really found anything historically. Like, it's the first time in my lifetime that I've seen the idea of hate speech weaponized against libertarian movements. And I do think it's because of the Zionist lobby. And, like, since 2023, I personally was not very connected with Palestine before 2023. That was a sort of like, I'm one of the many people who became active on Palestine after October 2023, when we went, hang on, what the hell?
Yeah.
You can't just genocide a whole people. I was unaware of just how powerful the Zionist lobby is. But anyone who's been active in that space, and Palestinians themselves, have been saying this for a long time. So to see, you know, federal laws passed, and then in Sydney and in New South Wales and in Queensland, laws passed aimed specifically at the pro-Palestine movement, is pretty disturbing. But yeah, it was a real eye-opener for me. I mean, on the one hand, it's been wonderful to be part of a movement that has such a huge groundswell of support and so many new people stepping up to take action, and it being global, seeing it happen in, you know, Uganda, in Bhutan, in, you know, all across Europe and the Americas. Like, it's, you know, it's been wonderful. And it is revealing how powerful Zionism is.
Yeah.
Certainly in Australia. I mean,
the protesters,
but also through the arts, literature, journalism, visual art, music. Like, so many people have been impacted by Zionist complaints.
Yeah, absolutely. And on the, I guess, the other side of that is that Palestinian resistance movements really underpin, as do First Nations resistance, underpin so much of the change that we see today and have really carried the movements that are still going strong today. And 3CR, the history of 3CR, I could see how there's a history of silencing Palestinian speech, and I saw some parallels with the current hate speech laws. So I thought that was interesting that it's the first time that these laws have kind of been widely recognised as being suppressive to liberatory justice movements, but there is actually a history. This is actually a practice that has roots in older methods of silencing Palestinian people and liberatory justice movements. Now, there's something I want to touch on that you did mention before, things like police doing raids and then actually not charging people. There's been a lot of reports of police using bureaucratic violence or process as punishment against individuals who are involved in liberatory justice. Can you expand on this more?
I'm not sure what you mean by bureaucratic violence.
I guess the process of going through court or having to meet bail conditions. It's alleged that people have had their housing impacted by raids that actually didn't result in any kind of charges. Yeah.
I wouldn't really probably call that bureaucratic violence. I'd just call it violence, structural violence. So often for the police, these raids are part of an overall policing project strategically incapacitate us. So the point of the policing is not to arrest criminals.
Absolutely, yeah.
It is not to prosecute criminal behaviour. The point of the policing is to disrupt and demobilise activists. So raids are just one technique. And, I mean, these raids, you know, think 20 women times 12 police each. That's like around 250 police mobilised. And that's just the ones who are on scene. That's not all the people who are back in the office doing the grunt work on the keyboards. So, you know, 250 police mobilised against people who have, women who have no history of violence, many of whom have no criminal history whatsoever. It is designed to intimidate. You know, it is absolutely there to intimidate and make women fearful. And then the charges, as I said, I think in my case the most serious crime I may have committed is littering. But they often throw charges at you that they know won't stand up, but they know they're going to drop before they go to court in order to justify a tranche of bail conditions that are really restrictive and that will demobilise you.
Zelda,
will stop you organising.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I really appreciate your insight based on lived experience and, yeah, many years of action. So thank you so much for joining us this morning. I hope to speak with you again soon.
Okay, no worries.
You just heard from Zelda, who helped us understand how policing and legislative tactics are being further leveraged to criminalise liberatory justice movements and silence political speech. Zelda has been active in earth and human rights struggles on this continent and the Pacific region for decades and was a core organiser of Disrupt Land Forces. Currently, Zelda is preparing to head to Pine Gap for next month's Sacred Land Back Convergence, and we hope to see you at the convergence.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is just coming up to 8:01 in the morning, and we are about to head to our next interview. But before that, I'll do a quick weather check. So today we are expecting a high of 14 degrees Celsius, a low of 8 degrees. And right now it's sitting at just around 9 degrees. So let us head to our next interview. Inez, take it away.
Thank you so much. I am now joined by Lucinda Thorpe, who's at Digital Rights Watch, to talk to me about the concerns with WA police expansion of facial surveillance. And it really acts as a really disproportionate and terrifying overreach of police infrastructure, which is a key theme that we've heard in all the previous interviews. Thanks so much, Lucinda, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
How are police currently using surveillance tech, just very briefly? I know it's quite broad. And why is WA police specifically doing this or claim it's being used for?
Okay, so WA police have rolled out one live facial surveillance van, and it appears to have cameras attached to it. The cameras scan the faces of everybody walking past, and then an AI will compare their face against a database of about 4,000 people with outstanding warrants or they're missing people of interest, etc.
That is, astonishing. Yeah, keep going.
Mm-hmm. If the AI detects a match, this person will presumably be arrested or picked up by police. I do want to note here, is not the only way the WA police or police in Australia use facial surveillance. Even in interviews, Commissioner, don't worry. This is a really overt way that we use it. We use it covertly all the time. Like, that is not happening. And people should really stop proposing benefits from policy. The risks that arise from collecting the facial everyone who walks by, such as data leaks and, you know, their deep fake implications.
Hey, Lucinda, so sorry to... No, I agree 100%. I just really want to keep hearing what you're saying, but I think there's just a little bit of feedback, or you're cutting in and out a little bit. Were you able to maybe... if you're using, like, maybe headphones, if we could just go on a phone, I'm not really sure what's happening right now.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Is this better?
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you so much. So sorry about that. We were talking about how horrific AI is, and of course, it's not the only way that WA police use this to, surveil people and criminalise people. And
so people should be really sceptical of any proposed safety benefits from this policy. The risks that arise from collecting, you know, the facial data of everyone who walks past, for example, if that data were to leak and what that data could be used for in a deepfake context, on top of the just erosion of the human right to privacy that this policy presents, that far outweighs any possible benefit from identifying people in the community.
Absolutely. And I think really emphasising that people should be really concerned, and not to like fearmonger, but I think there is a real challenge of understanding how this is being used, because we know the tracking and the surveillance of the data is bad, but I'm really curious about the details of this, and what Digital Rights Watch have really spoken about is like, how are these problems being exemplified, particularly for people of colour, and how what data is even being put in there to generate this kind of surveillance?
Mm-hmm. So AI facial recognition programs train on faces that they have found on the internet. And unfortunately, the internet is not a representative sample of the whole world. And therefore, the AIs are far better at identifying white, middle-aged men. And they're pretty mediocre at correctly identifying everyone else, particularly people of colour. On the whole, even the most advanced AI facial recognition software gets it wrong about 1 out of 10 times.
1 out of 10 is a lot. That is a lot. And I think we see this with, I think, so much of technology. I think we see that it's not completely neutral, and the people that are programming this, how it's designed, are not generating, they're not even thinking about people of colour because there's nobody in the room, but also I don't really want us to be in the room either. You know, like, sure, the data should be a little bit better, and it should be better to discern and not use it in the first place. But yeah, I feel really like conflicted on that because you're not, the data collection is already so dubious, but I really want to know what are the knock-on effects of being misidentified. Let's say there are like two, collection of people and they're darker skinned and the AI doesn't know how to differentiate between any of them or similar facial features, and you get misidentified by WA police through AI surveillance, and then what happens?
Yep, so it means that already over-policed minority groups like First Nations people are more likely to be incorrectly matched against the subject and therefore more likely to have unwanted interactions with police. So this could place them in police custody, which has historically and currently not a safe place for First Nations people. And unfortunately, this isn't just a hypothetical. In the US, where this technology has been more widely rolled out, there's been at least 8 people who have been wrongfully arrested following incorrect AI facial recognition. Just 2 weeks ago, Jalil Richardson, a black man from North Carolina, was exonerated after spending 3 months in jail because an AI incorrectly identified him as the suspect in a case.
Yeah, it is so horrific to hear that automation and techno-fascist movements are becoming so ingrained. Like, we have Palantir in the NHS, we have AI in policing, in the NDIS, and I find it really, really concerning. We've spoken about AI, yeah, it's similar in different police contexts too. Knowing how horrible it is when people do get misidentified, how does a system even bother to correct a mistake? Let's say that somebody's been misidentified, you know, heaven forbid they spend time in prison, and yeah, they need to say, this person is not part of the system, I made a mistake, I made a correction. What happens?
So once a person matches a suspect, it's really hard to retrain the system to exclude them. So that person could be repeatedly harassed by police while just going about their life. You know, I can't speak to the specifics of that AI program that the WA police are running, but typically, if there's a bug in the system that is, I mean, it's not a bug, it's by design, that is poorly identifying between two faces, you would have to go into the system and basically do a mass retraining. It's hard to kind of target that specific mistake which is being made between two faces. So it can be very hard to retrain these systems.
Well, so the only way to fix it is to retrain the entire system. So multiple people will probably be misidentified and the system will not correct it after upending someone's life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm really curious, yeah, WA's police would be using this for their own police services, but how will this impact other domains like protests?
Yeah. So the police commissioner of WA refused to rule out the use of this facial surveillance technology at protests, strikes or rallies. So it feels inevitable that this technology will be used to surveil, profile and target Australians who are just exercising their democratic rights to association and free speech. This could discourage people from attending rallies. It can also place people of colour at these protests at risk of AI misidentification and then subsequent police harassment.
Yeah. Thank you so much for explaining that. It's so, so important. And I know that we can find out so much more through Digital Rights Watch. And we will have all the information in our show notes. But thank you so much, Lucinda, for coming on the show and talking about how important and pervasive this is, and it's not a neutral tool. But thank you so much, Lucinda.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. And that was Lucinda from Digital Rights Watch, and we spoke about how WA is police expansion of facial surveillance using AI is like a huge overreach of police infrastructure. And from that, I have been going to Little Homie, which is a cafe, a beautiful community space, to watch a lot of the World Cup games. And this is my interview with the owner, just talking about why the place is so special. I've never experienced a place like it. Abu Chan from Little Homie. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I've been coming here for the World Cup Games, and it's such a beautiful space. Could you tell us a little bit more about why this space is so special and what it means to you and the community?
I guess like Little Homie was made just to create a space in the inner north for people of colour, primarily, but honestly for everybody, just to create a space for people to come, connect, talk to people, make friends, share in culture and creativity. Yeah, just wanted to be a place where you could be yourself and you could kind of take off any of the filters.
Yeah, beautiful. I think there's so many spaces that maybe will champion community and they can feel a little bit exclusive, but coming here, it really is like you're just chatting to everybody, screaming and hoping that people win these games. And I'm curious if there are, yeah, any other events and promos that are coming up here, because just I really want everybody to come to Little Homie.
I appreciate you, man. I feel like, we've got lots on. Every weekend we do something new and different. We try to collaborate with a lot of like small businesses and local creatives. Off the top of my head, we have a clothing market this Sunday. We'll be showing the Ghana versus Croatia. Ghana versus Croatia at 7 a.m. And then after that, we have a secondhand clothing market. We have 15 kind of local collectors that will be selling their stuff. So that's this Sunday, the 28th of June. And then we also have next week, Saturday, on the 4th of July, we have a community games night. So board games, video games. I'm pretty sure the host is also doing like a mafia, kind of like a mafia game, which is pretty cool. So, I think like Little Homie, our goal is just to bring people together, connect, get people off their phones and just talk, you know?
Yeah. Amazing. Thanks so much. Well, everybody, please go follow Little Homie. That's H-O-M-E-Y. And on Instagram, and we'll put that in our show notes. And please come along. Come along on Sunday for the market and for the games.
That was a very cute little promo of Little Homie. And now take it away, Kate.
We are joined by Anitra Nelson, who is an activist scholar with the Informal Urbanism Research Hub at the University of Melbourne, who investigates post-capitalism and non-monetary economies. As 3CR looks back at the 2000 Melbourne S11 protests that occurred under a broad coalition against globalisation, we're joined by Anitra to speak with us about the phenomenon of degrowth and its relationship to the globalised and capitalist world that we live in today. So Anitra has also worked as a programmer on 3CR's Chile Lucha show in the past. So welcome to the show, and how does it feel to be back in studio?
Well, it's pretty amazing because like I go from my younger self to my older self. Yes, I was studying at La Trobe University in the Institute of Latin American Studies and worked with Barry Carr and Steve Niblow as the kind of academic and English side contingent of Chile Lucha, Chile Fights, which was a bilingual program. Quite focused on Chile, but also incorporated news from Latin America generally.
Mm. And we had a bit of a chat prior to starting our interview here, and you sort of walked me through your transition from Latin American studies into more like post-capitalist economies and economics. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what degrowth is and why we need it.
Yes, well, I became involved in the degrowth movement in around 2012. I'd already heard of degrowth through the Journal of Ecological Economics primarily, and I was a research fellow in New York. And in Montreal, I noticed there was the first degrowth conference at the Americas. Mm-hmm. And so I went up to Montreal and it was a real blast. The conference popped up at different universities every day, mm-hmm. and had this amazing kind of number of different people, including David Suzuki, speaking. And I was very impressed by the broad and activist nature of the movement. And the degrowth movement principles are to live within the limits of Earth, but also to live more equitably and convivially. In other words, be very concerned about justice between people. So there's a democratic kind of a direct democracy angle of degrowth, as well as an ecological and economic kind of and social sides of it. So it's quite a, it's more of a philosophical movement in many ways.
And why is it that we need degrowth, you know, now and in the past or in the future?
Well, I think that the two outstanding global challenges are inequities between people, and that's between countries. So one of the things that a lot of degrowth advocates support is delinking. Also, just if we look at Australian society, the inequities are really large, and they just seem to be increasing. The other aspect is that we're facing an ecological crisis, not just carbon emissions. The problem with climate change is really just a symptom of the whole Earth suffering under all of our extractive production and that kind of thing.
All very wound up with one another, the economies and the environment and extractivism.
So degrowth, kind of like the word comes from challenging this whole notion of growth, which comes back to capitalism being money, making more money. And that's where it links in with all my investigations around money itself,
And I was wondering if you could maybe talk us through where degrowth stands in relation to globalisation. Are they conflicting dynamics? How do they relate to one another?
Well, a lot of degrowth activists are involved in other movements, and a lot of them were involved in ultra-globalisation. And I would say that what some people have said is that while degrowth played a small role in those activities, it has actually become a more permanent kind of representation of the kinds of things that were being argued then. And I mean, this is largely because of we actually face stronger forces in terms of geopolitics and things like that.
And in some of your work, you speak about the non-human nature of capitalism. And I was just wondering if you could talk us through what that means.
So capitalism, like one of the reasons I became really interested in ecological economics was that in the market, nature and human beings are just sort of treated like resources. And this is the, just by the very nature of the capitalist system, it's people are reduced to what they can work, how they can work, and nature is just considered in terms of how useful it is to capitalism. And this is really awful for both people and the planet, because all of their qualities, and I would say quality of life is the most important thing, are really ignored and constantly challenged. And so a lot of us just get exhausted resisting all the time.
Caught on the wheel and of this transactional relationship that doesn't necessarily serve, you know, humans or the environment. So I'm just wondering if you spoke a little bit about, I guess, like the geopolitical environment that we're in, and the United States has long been like the dominant force in the globalized world and capitalist system that we live within today. So as other powers, like in particular like China, become more influential and the world, the global power balance shifts, I'm just wondering if you think that this makes degrowth more or less achievable?
I suppose both. So we're tending to move now more into where people are taking up more extreme positions in either direction. So the far right has always been a real challenge to degrowth, which is all for, for having a really open kind of world. In terms, however, of the geopolitics is meaning, for instance, that most countries are really markedly increasing their military budget.
Mm.
And I just think that this is a massive challenge to all social and environmental movements, because we're also seeing increased legislation just against mere protest. This is just mere speech, mm. you know. Yeah.
And obviously money plays like a very big role within, you know, capitalist structures. And, you know, you have done a little bit of research into non-monetary economic setups. And I'm just, yeah, how does that sort of play out? Like what would happen if we got rid of, you know, money, and would there be something that replaced it? Or, yeah, what's the idea around a non-monetary world?
Okay, so rather than alternative currencies that are quite popular, I see that and there's a gaggle of people who think along the same terms as I do. I think that money has become the decision-making tool in our society. So the way of replacing money is by people being directly involved in democracy. So assemblies, like horizontal kind of governance. And in this way, all people would be involved in planning economic activities.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine that people would be forming groups to work out what their needs would be,
mm-hmm.
and having principles of just satisfying your needs, not kind of luxuries. And then those people themselves, as much as possible locally, collectively producing for those needs, and exchanging, but on a non-monetary basis,
mm-hmm.
Any of those goods and services that they themselves can't achieve to create locally.
Mm.
Then you don't need a market or money, because the people have, you know, basically ordered what they want,
mm-hmm.
or what they need,
mm-hmm.
and therefore as soon as they're produced, they go to those people. So there mm-hmm. isn't a market, there isn't money. And I actually came to the position of arguing for these kinds of economies because capitalism and growth don't produce for people. We've got 1 billion people on the planet who don't even get enough or the right kind of food.
Mm.
I mean, it doesn't, there's no, like, there was always this kind of trickle-down theory, which is really basically rubbish, and yeah. So all of that needs to be turned around.
Mm. And if people were wanting to find out more about degrowth, or even wanting to maybe get some tips about, you know, things that they could do in their daily lives to, you know, work towards degrowth, like, how could people find out information?
If people go online to the Commons Social Change Library and punch in degrowth, I've written a guide that's like that, that's just kind of like basically an introduction to degrowth, and it's the managers of the Commons Library actually change it as, you know, according to some of the Degrowth Network Australia input and things like that, so it's updated a bit. And also just by going online and putting in degrowth, because recently last year we launched a Rutledge handbook on degrowth, and it's all of the chapters are open access.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, so they can go onto the Rutledge site and have a look there too.
Awesome. We can definitely include links to what you've just spoken about in our show notes. And, yeah, it's been very enlightening speaking with you, Anitra. And, yeah, it's a concept that might seem very, you know, I don't know, I don't want to use the word far-fetched, but perhaps not. So thank you for coming on the show, and it's been great to speak with you, Anitra.
Thanks a lot, Kate.
We're celebrating celebrating 50 years of 3CR on Saturday, the 4th of July at Collingwood Town Hall. There'll be stalls, displays, great food, performances, activities, prizes, and so much more. It's a birthday for us, and we can't wait to celebrate with you. Saturday, the 4th of July, Collingwood Town Hall, 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. Bring your family, tell your friends, all are welcome. 3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Let us know you're coming. Go to Humanitix and search for 3CR to RSVP.
RCR celebrating 50 years.
Throughout the month of June, we're asking you to support fierce, independent and community-controlled media by making a donation to our Radiothon.
We'll be taking donations online, over the phone and in the station to help keep 3CR going for another year.
To donate, go to 3cr.org.au, call the station on 03 94 19 8377,
or drop in at 21 Smith Street, Fitzroy, during business hours.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
All right, we are coming up to the end of our show today on Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And a reminder there as well, we have raised about half of the $300,000 that we need to keep the station on air for another year. So please keep chipping in, donating if you can. And our sincere thanks to everybody who's donated so far, especially everyone who has donated to Thursday Breakfast. Now, we'll just take you quickly through what we had on the show today. First up, we played another segment from the archives where 3CR was broadcasting from the protests outside the World Economic Forum from the 11th to the 13th of September 2000.
And after that, we heard a 1998 interview with 3CR station manager at the time, Jan MacArthur, who spoke about the 1997 Victorian secret police infiltration at 3CR.
And then we were joined by trans activist Hazel talking about electoral fascism, the failure of liberal politics, and an upcoming counter-protest for trans liberation on Saturday, the 4th of July.
And after that, we heard from Zelda, who helped us understand how policing and legislative tactics like hate crime law are being leveraged to further criminalise liberatory justice movements and silence political speech.
We were then joined by Lucinda Thorpe from Digital Rights Watch to talk about WA's police's expansion of facial surveillance. And we were finally joined by Anitra Nelson, who is an activist scholar from the Informal Urbanism Research Hub, and spoke with us about degrowth, what it is, where it stands in relation to globalization and neoliberal policies, and how it may work in practice. Now, we really encourage folks to come along to next week's 50th anniversary celebrations.
Yes.
On the 4th of July. They're going to be at the Collingwood Town Hall. You can find out more information at 3cr.org.au. And again, if you get your scheduling right, you can head to the counter and also to our celebrations. So we look forward to seeing you at both.
Yeah, hopefully you'll get to see us in real life, apart from just hearing our voices on the radio.
Amazing. We will catch you next week and stay tuned for Lost in Science. Goodbye.
Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.